This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 63 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Very well, then, Peter. Hello, everybody.
And sadly, Gareth Stringer, who is, of course, the editor, the executive editor at Global Aviation Resource, cannot be with us today. As many of you know, he has a rather demanding job and has been called out, so he will be back in the next week or two. But we're very, very lucky to be joined by Marissa Garcia from FlightSheet.com, the runway's runway. Marissa is a freelance journalist and writer producing content on all aspects of the airline and passenger experience. She's a regular contributor to Aviation Interiors International magazine, and prior to journalism was Director of Marketing and Corporate Relations for Hoover Industries, Inc., where she was involved in the development, certification, installation, and maintenance of aircraft interiors products. Marissa is a self-confessed aerospace geek. Marissa, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter, and hello, Tim.
Hello again.
I think you last met in Toulouse at Airbus, so I'm sure we'll get to talk about some items along the way. But also in today's show, we focus very much on airlines and the passenger experience. We get to talk to Paul Papandimitriou from the Layovers podcast, who is a high-volume aviation traveller, and he is an avgeek as well. And we ask him about what he's seen in the developing passenger environment. We also get to talk to 747 pilot Mark Van Honecker, who has written probably the best book on what being a pilot really means, and that is, of course, Skyfaring. And we've got three copies of Skyfaring to give away. So, along with feedback promoting aerospace, this show is, as always, fully loaded. So let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Tim, let me come to you first. Our last show came from Farnborough, and a big thank you again to Boeing for all they did for us. But looking back now, cold light of dawn, as they say, what was your view of Farnborough?
Obviously the big thing beforehand was the Brexit fallout from Brexit. That was kind of the big story from there. Political changes, obviously, in the UK, and then we had the first visit of the F-35 to the UK, which appeared at Riyadh first, and then it came along to Farnborough and basically stole the show. Vertical landing, vertical sort of hovering, and it was one of those things that kind of. 2 years ago, it had the engine fire and there'd been kind of embarrassment all round, very disappointing. Now it kind of rocked up and in service now with the US Marine Corps. As we speak, the USAF is about to declare initial operating capability and much more confidence now about the aircraft, what it can do. 150 aircraft now in service, experience is being built up, and it was amazing. There's people there who are kind of, couple of years previously had been diehard sort of F-35 skeptics who went away from that weekend and said, "Oh, actually, I'm a convert, to F-35 fans," which is pretty weird. And it's also important to remember that the hovering bit is party trick. Remembers and loves the Harrier, what that does. the F-35B's party trick is only a tiny part of what it can do. The real clever stuff is on this side. It's the low observable, it's the sensor fusion. It's that stuff that is the and the software that makes it all happen. That's the real kind of clever bit, rather than the vertical landing. So there was that. We had the defence deals on the first day of the show. Prime Minister turned up. We had Pierce signed for. We had Apache. So defence deals led the kicked off the kind of week's sales frenzy, which is a bit weird. Usually it's the other way around, and the defence people go away at the end of the week, and they kind of feel sort of overshadowed by the commercial. And then at the end of the week, there's about $124 billion worth of orders and options for aircraft signed. So Farnborough obviously were claiming that, you know, that was a good deal. There was big orders from AirAsia. Airbus came home and kind of romped home with the amount of orders and commitments secured. Boeing was trailing behind them. They did pick up some nice commitments there for Maxes, which is the star of the show. And also, interestingly, a commitment for 20 747-8Fs, a freighter version of the 747, which was actually there at the show, which I think was quite a rarity. Not at Farnborough, no. However, here's the however bit, is that once you took some of the... the headline figure of the firm orders, there was 461 aircraft sold, orders or commitments. Once you took away the MOUs, the LOIs, and the commitments, that went down to just 186 firm orders for Airbus and just 20 for Boeing. So there's a bit of smoke and mirrors going on there. Having said that, both Airbus and Boeing are sitting on, you know, huge backlogs, you know, maybe decades worth of work. Finally, I think the other interesting thing maybe was Embraer, who turned up not only with their new E190 E2 re-engined airliner. That had only just flown previously in May, so to get it to Farnborough is, you know, incredible. But also their KC-390 and also a BizJet, whose name I can't remember right at the moment. But they brought three aircraft. So big turnout there from Eric.
Yeah, okay. And we saw picking out a few of those, particularly the airliner orders. The one that stood out for me was Virgin for the A350, yeah. Of course. And that was the 1,000, wasn't it? The A350-1000.
That's right,
which,
yeah.
Which we've just seen rolled out, I think, order for 10 of those. Let's just connect those stories then on to some other things we want to look at. Marissa, I want to come to you. We saw an A380 there, as always. Fantastic demonstration. But I have to say, Boeing's were as well. I loved the 737 MAX as well. But Airbus have, in the last week or so, said that they're going to reduce A380 production to one a month. Boeing has also suggested the end of the 747 is in sight. Is this the end of the very large aircraft, given the fact that, you know, airlines like JetBlue and Norwegian are now talking about the A321LR for transatlantic routes?
Well, see, I don't think that those things are mutually exclusive. And what I mean is we are going to have a massive demand for aircraft of large size and of small size. And both Boeing and Airbus agree on the need for smaller double aisles and the need for a large quantity of single aisle aircraft. That's undoubted. But Airbus makes what I think is a very compelling argument in favor of jumbo jets. It doesn't just mention the A380, though it certainly means the A380, between the big megacities. And there is something to that. Because our air traffic management systems are not going to be able to keep up with massive amounts of aircraft flying at the same time, and our airports are not necessarily ready to receive a huge amount of aircraft landing at the same time. There is a benefit to the large aircraft of between big hubs of transporting larger groups of people. Now, of course, airlines have to decide how to make that economically viable, but you have airlines like Emirates who have found that it can be extremely efficient when you can fill the aircraft to the point where they've reduced the first class and on routes like Copenhagen to Dubai simply have a two-class cabin with more people on there. So there is demand and there is a use for it. But I understand, you know, why Airbus would have cut production because right now they really have a lot of business with the A350 too. You know, they really don't necessarily need to be building an aircraft that has lower orders right now. And then on top of that, on the 747, I take it very personally because the 747 and I took off on the same day, exactly the same day. I don't know if it was the same time, but so I have a great love for the 747, have all my life. And I can, again, understand why Boeing is going back and forth on this, especially since they're the ones pushing the argument against jumbo. But, you know, if they're keeping the freighter, they can always just go back and reintroduce the passenger plane if they need to. I think it's too soon to write off jumbos, although in the short term, they may not necessarily benefit. They may not necessarily boost. But in the long term, over the next 20 years, I think Airbus is going to be right. I think we're going to need larger aircraft.
Right. Okay. Let me then just, I suppose, throw another one into the mix. As I mentioned, Norwegian and JetBlue are talking about the A321LR, which isn't yet tested on some of these transatlantic routes they've been talking about. Boeing has made some comment about the 757 replacement, but seems to be, I don't know if procrastinating is the right word, but are they going to miss out on some of these A321LR orders that are going Airbus's way because they haven't got a 757 replacement?
The MAX is getting hammered by the A321. So the question that faces Boeing is, what do they do with it? They've got a plan to slightly tweak the top end MAX, give that a tiny little bit of a stretch, but they're a bit constrained by how much they can actually do with that. So the next leap is if you're going to go for a 757, is it a 757 replacement? Is it something more? Is it the start of a new family? How does it fit into the whole kind of the rest of the range, et cetera. The latest scuttlebutt and kind of thinking seems to be that they're now seem to be sort of like casting the net wider and seem to be sort of saying, well, you know, this is more than a 757 replacement. We're talking to lots of airlines and they're telling us what they want. And it's not a question of, not a question of when. But it seems to be sort of like a bigger concept now. However, having said that, the flip side of that, the coin is how much, you know, Airbus and Boeing have both gone down the re-engineering route, and you know, when A320neo was being considered, when MAX was being considered, you know, there was a lot of pressure on both Airbus and Boeing to buy, you know, to kind of go a clean sheet. You know, why didn't you go and do a, you know, why didn't you go open rotor? Why didn't you do something, you know, kind of really sort of futuristic, sink some serious money into it and not do the re-engineering thing? They went a little more cautious there, and I think they've probably been proved right at the moment, because the other thing is the price of oil, you know, is kind of, who kind of predicted that, the fall in the price of oil? But two, you know, how mind-bogglingly expensive a brand new aircraft program is, and some of the charges that Boeing had came out last week about one-off charges for just two Dreamliners would make your eyes water. Flight test aircraft, you know, that are still costing them money. So, given this 757 notional, you know, middle of the market mom, aircraft might be just for a limited number of customers. You know, it's obviously going to take some sort of hard thinking as to, you know, how much are we prepared to spend on this and how big is the market.
Okay, well, let's move on then to talk about airline service and some of the things going on in the industry. We ran our own little survey on Twitter over the past week or so, and we asked the question, has airline service improved in the last 5 years? The results were that 25% of the respondents said yes, 54% said no, and 21% said there was no change. So almost half said that there'd been no change, or in fact, services had improved. Marissa, what's your view on that?
I'd like to know the demographics of the respondents.
You got me there.
The reason I say that, I think it's a matter of perception based on two factors. One of them is your lifestyle experience, and the other being your age. I think that there's this cult of the golden age that has taken hold. And sometimes I wonder if it isn't just a whole bunch of aviation observers convincing each other that they're right about the lost golden years, while the general flying public doesn't care. Because, objectively looking at the product, having worked on it since 1994, I think it's improved. And I say that based on having built those seats, knowing that the lean seats are actually better for passengers than the ones we used to build that were based on hard rock foam because it floated. And I know that
that's quite controversial, though, isn't it, to say that you feel that that had improved. I'm not to argue the results or the demographics of our survey, but that straw poll, most people said no, it hasn't improved. My view of that point you just made about the golden era is I sort of thought about my very first flight on a 707. Luckily enough, to somewhere in the Caribbean, and I had flying fish and knives and forks and things like that. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, is that the service I now get in first class that I used to get in economy? So it's a perception, and it is only a perception, but my reality is fixed by almost my last experience. And we talked before we started recording about social media and the immediacy of information. People are so demanding these days. Do you think their standards are different?
I think it's because of two factors. I mean, there is no doubt that in order to compete for the low fares and to allow democratization of travel, airlines have gone lean. That's undisputable. You know, you don't have you don't have the playing cards coming to you, you know, of the years that we had. But you have a seat back screen that you could never have imagined having in economy. And I remember when we tried to put on the first LCD little screens that we put on Continental, and everybody laughed at them. We could never have imagined that in 1996 that today you'd have a full computer screen in front of you with full color and could touch it, and that was just unimaginable. So it's relative to what it is that you treasure. If you treasure cutlery, then yes, you don't have cutlery anymore because there are no meals. but if you look at other advances that you get, and the most important thing to my mind is that the idea of going home to visit overseas was something we had to save up for, like you would save to put a deposit down on a house. Now, you know, you just don't think about flying over the transatlantic flight. You can fly for just a couple hundred dollars, you know, if you fly low cost. That's amazing. That's crazy. In fact, I think some of the rates are too low. So, yeah, it's all relative. What do you value? If you value the VIP treatment, you can fly in first class today, again, like you could not imagine in the 90s or even in the 00s. Yeah. There was
I'm earlier than that, no, by the way, but thank you.
There was no expectation of that level of first-class service in the best of times in aviation. It just was not imaginable. So relative to what have we lost? Now, again, there are more people flying. So sometimes I say the demographic thing because I think, well, you know, if you come from a privileged background where flying was part of your everyday and there were very few who could do that. And now all of a sudden you have all the riffraff coming in, if you will. That's in quotes. I say that ironically, you know, then you feel offended. You've lost your privilege. Yeah. But if you had no privilege to begin with, then it's a wonder, you know. So it's, you know, yes, there are things that we've lost and there are things that we've won. And that's the nature of growing older. You are always looking at the reverse mirror and saying somehow it was much more beautiful in the 70s. But if you got into the time capsule, you wouldn't want to be there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Interestingly enough, I think my view of the last 5 years is there has been an improvement. I've seen better services on some of the airlines that I use regularly, and by service I mean the attentiveness of the cabin crew. And for me, the process starts at the point at which I decide to make that flight, and it includes everything from their website to the booking system to the cost, as well as the airports as well.
I think you know, you've got a very good point there about the you know, golden age of air travel. Wasn't all really that golden, and you know, we get kind of swept up in the kind of rose tinted glasses and the swish kind of, oh yes, it was, you know, everyone was kind of you know, well, the people who had the money to travel, you know, before everybody ever could travel. But it's interesting, some of the, if you read some of the contemporary you know, magazines of the time, and you know, kind of, I think I read something, you know, something in Life or something of that, and some of the complaints sounded very, very sort of, you know, sort of similar. That you know, the phone lines, that, you know, nobody could get in touch with the airline. There was nowhere to sit in the and this is, I think, from, you know, late 40s, 50s. You know, nowhere to sit in the terminal. And, you know, it was just too busy. People were, you know, there was too much queuing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And you look at that guy thinking, this sounds, you know, complaint about customer service back in the 1950s. This sounds a bit familiar.
Yeah. Well, let me bring you both crashing down to earth, literally. A story in the Telegraph and one in the Los Angeles Times. The Telegraph talks about, in the UK, ministers talking about cracking down on banning alcohol, and the Los Angeles Times is reporting that some airlines, some legacy airlines, are talking about no food or drink on long-haul international flights. Does this come back, I suppose, to the point you've made, Marissa, about expectations? So if I've got my Wi-Fi, do I care about food? And secondly, are we in a society that has, I suppose, encouraged things like drinking and alcohol abuse and other abuse that literally just steps on an aeroplane as it does on our pavements?
Well, I think there are two distinct factors there, although I agree they overlap. But if I can first address the food and beverage issue, I think that's a branding issue. I think low-cost carriers should go lean, and they should, in keeping with their fares, they should let it all be optional and let people buy what they like. And if they have the money for it, super. And if they don't, they don't have it. And I think full service airlines make a mistake if they go and match that, because I really believe that you have to differentiate the two. And I think full service airlines would be wrong to continue the mistake that's been going on for the past 30 plus, almost 40 years now, of trying to beat low-cost carriers at the low-fares wars. I think that's self-destructive. But that's, you know, that's a long conversation. But basically, even if both of them on their cheapest fares were to say, okay, food and beverage is an added cost, it probably doesn't matter today because people are used to it. You know, you'll on full service carriers, you'll have some griping, but it's not that unusual that you know, you get to pay extra for everything now. But alcohol I think should always be a pay for item. And I know you're going to get comments saying, you know, what is that about? Don't have her again on the show. But I think it should be a pay for item because it's a safety hazard. People don't know how to handle alcohol. Alcohol on board does lead to disruption. And I think airlines should not be giving it away because it creates this up. Really uncomfortable situation for safety personnel on board, namely the crew. Would they have to confront somebody who's a drunk and on board and say to them, I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off the free booze? It enrages the person and it creates an uncomfortable situation for them because they know it's already a safety issue. Whereas if they can say to the person, hey, you know, if you want to have another beer, your price just went up, or, you know, your limit is this much. Or we're out of the stock, whichever of those it is. But if it gives a restriction, if they can charge for it. The only thing I don't agree with is the ground-based. Because
I was going to say, doesn't the problem often start before some of these individuals even get on the aircraft in the airport?
I did a report on that for Passenger Terminal World a year and a half ago, when, you know, specifically dealing with this. And what we found was that there are a lot of restrictions at the terminal already on what people drink. And there is a police presence, and concessioners are already told to cut people off if they seem to be drinking too much. Plus, airlines do not have to let anyone board if they seem to be in any way a problem. So anybody who is evidently inebriated, they should not be boarded. And if they are boarded, then it's the airline's failure there. But the problem is if you have somebody who's had a bit much to drink, but they don't seem evidently drunk, and then they get on board, they get free alcohol, it just gets more severe, you know. So it's that combination.
And the altitude as well. That can affect people as well, can't it? The cabin pressure and that sort of thing aids in promoting that sort of drunkenness.
Yes, because cabins are dry environments. You get dehydrated, and lack of water is what makes you drunk. You know, alcohol, you need to, you're washing it down. But basically, yeah, you have a very dangerous situation there. But is it fair, I'll ask you, to allow airlines to grow their ancillaries while asking concessionaires at the airport to lose their revenue? That's the trick in balancing it out. I mean, we all want safer flights, and we all want nobody being disgusting on a flight. Like there was an incident on, I think it was on EasyJet, you know, just really, really disgusting people and fighting and all of that. You know, you want to avoid all of that because it's a hazard, a serious safety hazard. But does that mean that people should not be able to buy alcohol if they choose to do so? I think they should be able to. But they should not expect to get it. I think that needs to be cut off. And I mean in all classes. And that's why I say people are going to write you and say, I must be nutty. But I would even say that, you know, alcohol should be at least restricted first class. Because one of the things we don't talk about, yes, we talk about the stag parties and all of that, but we've had a lot of people become disruptive in first class because they've been inebriated. You know, you've had people, you know, just really creating a bad situation on board in first class.
I mean, that tallies. We had a conference with the Royal Aeronautical Society where we had something from one of the major airlines, flies transatlantic, and you know, their observation was the air rage incidents. Majority of air rage incidents come from the first class, and they said, you know, everybody in economy, you know, they're flying transatlantic, they're with families, they're excited about the experience. It's probably the first time they've been to the States, so they're quiet and they're just kind of enjoying the IFE. Everybody in business class is down working, and it's the D-list celebs, or people who think they're D-list celebs, with all the free booze in the first class, you know. It were the thrill makers.
Right, okay. Well, let us move us on from that. Sorry, Tim. Yeah, I think you've got a very good point there. Let's just wrap up the news then. because it wouldn't be right if we didn't talk about airport expansion in the southeast of England without mentioning the latest development, which is, of course, that now London City Airport has received planning permission for expansion. No new runways, but a new taxiway and new terminal facilities and new aircraft stands. Where does this leave Heathrow and Gatwick now, Tim?
Well, I mean, they are still they're still waiting for some kind of decision. So, obviously, one, the other thing that came out of Farnborough, and I didn't mention this at the time, but we had a Farnborough where we had two prime ministers in the same week.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Which may be a first, possibly as a first, you know, if we'd got it. So, yeah, it's not really competing with Airbus or with Heathrow or Gatwick. Both of them now are, you know, there was supposed to be a decision actually last month, back in July. You know, new prime minister now, so everything is back up in the air. We are promised a decision will be taken by October, possibly. So there's still all to play for.
But does this London City investment change anything? It sort of felt a bit unusual. It came out of the blue. I don't think anyone expected it.
I don't know. It'd been kind of on the cards for a while and had been kind of bubbling under. But it's not. You know, 7 new aircraft stands, a parallel taxiway, you know, extension of the passenger terminal extension. You know, it's great for London City, but it's nowhere, you know, it's not going to sort of be a major kind of threat or nobody's going to look at that and go, well, we've expanded London City, that's it for, you know, airport expansion in the southeast. You know, we don't need to do anything with Gatwick or Heathrow now. It's just something that will, you know, benefit London City. The big battle is still ongoing, you know, we await in October whether, you know, new Prime Minister Theresa May decides to adopt the Airport Commission's recommendations and third runway at Heathrow, or whether she decides, you know, Gatwick gets a nod, or whether she says go back to the drawing board again. And this is the other thing, is the more, you know, the Airport Commission reported last year, it's already been 12 months, and the longer you leave it, the more opportunity there is for somebody to come back and say, hey, things have changed, traffic's changed, growth has changed, this has changed, that's changed, environmental factors have changed, go away and do it again, you know. So.
Oh, God, don't put that out there, Tim. We'll lose out forever. Okay, let's leave the main news items there. Thanks for that discussion. Really interesting stuff. And, of course, if you've got any views on any of those news stories, do get in contact with us. We'd love to hear your views on it. Marissa, I just want to come back and talk to you a little bit about your background and your involvement, I suppose, in the whole passenger experience arena. Tell us a little bit about how you came about to be a journalist writing about PAXX.
Well, I came to be a journalist because I wasn't working in the industry anymore. to be honest, I the company I worked for unfortunately closed. It was a bad situation there. I found myself taking a break just to decompress because it was that stressful, just to pursue my original career goal, which was to write. And after, my bestseller didn't sell best, I decided, might as well write about something I feel very passionate about and which I miss very much, which is aviation. So I started Flight Chic just sort of on a lark. I didn't expect it to go anywhere. And I reached out to Aircraft Interiors International magazine, with whom I had a previous relationship when I was, buying media. In my other job. And I asked them if they would be kind enough to give me a chance to write for them freelance again on occasion, which they did right away. And they've been, you know, wonderful because it's a top-notch publication for that specific sector. And that it just went off from there. I just got lucky, to be honest.
But you're very well published,
And I've been very happy.
Yeah, you're very well. You're hiding your light under a bushel. You're very well published in lots of media. I know I've spoken to you quite a few times on our sister program. What are you seeing as the major trends then in that whole area? What as fare paying passengers can we start to see as some of the innovations coming through? To make it a better experience for us?
Just to answer your question, in terms of the things I see coming, certification is going to get really difficult. And this is one thing that passengers underappreciate, that to make their flight safe, there is a big R&D investment in testing and destructive testing in particular. And I think that with the rules tightening, it's going to be much more difficult to see big changes in design. But on the flip side of that, we're going to see that the designs that go through are going to be exceptionally good. You know, when we look at some of the proposals out there for technical integration, technology integration, I mean, you look at something like the waterfront seat proposal from Panasonic and BE Aerospace and Teague and Foundation Design, all working together, which that alone, that, you know, you have major firms collaborating on a single design is wonderful. And what they're proposing is a full integrated seat that recognizes you, remembers your preferences, and it's just really state of the art. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. We're going to see a lot more in terms of digital simplification of the travel process. So you don't have to have the hassle of, you know, I remember when we used to have red tickets, you know, handwritten tickets, none of that going on. Just nice. I read something about SAS is planning to use biometric palm scans to let you on board. So, you know, that sort of magical technology that's going to just make things really smooth, that's what we should look forward to. In the cabin, better cabin climate conditions, better lighting, nicer seats that really work with you, lots and lots of entertainment for long-haul flights, improved meals, because I think we're getting better at figuring out what it takes to make food taste like food at altitude, a smoother process.
What's your take on the use of some kind of social media or kind of maybe big data is a better word for it, in terms of, we talked about the glamour of the golden age of air travel, where you know you got on a flight and the flight attendant, you know your name and have your, you know, your special wine ready, etc., your special newspaper, whatever. Now you've got kind of airlines have got all this data kind of floating around there. What do you think are the opportunities there for, you know, for seats to, you know, you get assigned a seat and, you know, it pulls up your favorites, you know, there's people kind of already experimenting with that, where you can sort of select somebody to talk to or kind of, you know, you can actually say, you know, with someone with the same interests or Facebook friends.
KLM, wasn't it? Yeah.
Do you think that could actually replace the gold or bring back the golden age of travel?
I think it's a beyond, let's call it the platinum age, but absolutely, that's what the waterfront seat does, and that's what the jazz seat does. I mean, exactly. You sit there and it remembers, based on your personal electronic device, it remembers what your favorite movies are. It remembers your frequent flyer number and whether you're a priority passenger or not a priority passenger. It can inform you that, you know, the delay that you had will not let you miss your connection, and that your luggage is okay en route. It can do a million things. The fact that we have connectivity on board and we have that data changes everything in terms of personalization. Now, can airlines adopt the technology quickly enough to deliver on that promise? It's going to be a little bit of a lag time, but I think that in the next 15 years, we're going to be saying, well, you know, I can't believe that they do this now. Or we're going to be saying, I just take it for granted, of course. How did we ever live without it? You know, I think it's very, like any other technology, it's accelerating its pace. And despite the fact that aviation's technology adoption is delayed by regulation, there are many of these things that do not impact regulation at all, which will really help to move them along quickly.
Marissa, let's talk a little bit about, I suppose, the other side of the experience, and that's the airport, the arrival and the departure point. How joined up are airports and airlines these days? Because it often feels very, very disjointed. As a irregular traveller now, I don't travel as often as I used to. And I sort of, when I travelled more frequently, I suppose I acclimatised to those gaps in the service. Now I travel and, you know, using Tim's example of the family travelling to the States, it's much more of an experience for me. And I notice some of those things. What's being done to, I suppose, make that a little bit better?
Well, part of the problem is that you have a supplier and customer relationship between an airline and an airport, and sometimes it's very amicable and sometimes it's not. That, you know, the larger hubs are trickier to coordinate all of the happy customers and ensure a seamless process. Technology is making a big difference there. But I'll tell you, and this is just a quick aside, I am on a mission to avoid all hub airports and fly around the world with secondary airports, because I've had it with the big guys. Seriously, I whenever I plan my own travel, I try to find a secondary hub that will get me where I'm going. Because it is exactly what you say. It is a nuisance when you get to a huge airport and you just feel like, okay, my experience has just been shattered. You know, especially if you pay a high revenue. Now, to that, high revenue flyers have first class clubs and different things that make it easier, and you have the dedicated check-in. But for the economy passenger, it can feel like a huge overwhelming chaos. And I think the only thing that will make that better is a lot of technology to make a check-in unnecessary, with a quick baggage drop if you need it, if you don't travel light, and clear security quickly because you're pre-checked. All of those things will improve the process at the airport and make it feel nicer by the time you get there. And also flight information, you know, that needs to get up to date. They're almost got it right, but you'll find sometimes where you're notified of a gate change by the airport, but not by the airline. I don't know if you've used those travel apps. I use them constantly when I travel, and I've had a situation where my travel app was telling me I should be at one gate in a major airport, when in fact I should be on the complete opposite end of that at that same pier, and I, you know, with minutes to go, and it's just very frustrating. It's unnecessary. So once they get those things tweaked, then you'll see a smoother experience.
Okay, then let me just ask you one final question. It's a bit closer to home, literally, for you. You mentioned SAS earlier and innovation. Mm-hmm. We've in the past, quite recently, talked about Finnair and how they've really started to change the agenda and are finding a lot of success. And this week, Copenhagen Airport was awarded the most efficient airport in the world after already winning the best security and the best food. What is it about the northern part of Europe that makes those airlines and airports so innovative and so focused on improving?
The Nordics travel more than any other region of the world, practically. There are a heck of a lot of Nordic travelers. They spend a lot of money on it, and they they take every holiday possible. So there's a push to ensure that they're always happy and that they have very little hassle getting around. And they're also very long-haul travelers. So they also are used to they have high expectations of automated service. I mean, when you live in this region, you don't even carry cash today, yeah. You know? You just pay with you scan your phone to pay for anything, you know, even if it's just a coffee. So you're not used to a lot of, you know, old ways of doing things. You expect that it should be convenient and you should be able to just walk through. So they have a high bar to meet in order to keep their customers satisfied. At the same time, they're a small region. And it's very competitive and everybody wants to take their customers away. So someone like Copenhagen needs to be, an airport like Copenhagen needs to be very, very on point, very efficient, Helsinki as well. And, you know, it in order to captivate those customers and just keep them happy.
Right. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. Okay, we're going to leave the discussion there. We've still got lots to come with Get Involved and Promoting Aerospace. But after this break, we talk to seasoned air traveler Paul Papadimitriou about what the latest airline travel developments are and his podcast with Alex Hunter called Layovers.
Hi, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's own aviation podcast. I like to listen to Extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
I'm joined by Paul Papadimitriou, a seasoned traveller who's lived in Tokyo, Geneva, Manila, London and Limassol. Paul, welcome to Extended.
Thank you so much, Peter.
It's an absolute delight to have you with us. We're going to talk about your podcast, Layovers, a little later on, but I want to understand a bit more about your traveling, because I think for a lot of our listeners, you probably are you're in the ideal job. You get to fly a lot. You get to fly on different airlines, different aeroplanes, and all around the world. So where did this all start, Paul?
Oh, well, that's a long story. I mean, to be honest, I'm very lucky, first of all. I'm very privileged to be flying that much. I mean, obviously, I love flying, and I do fly, that's very important, I do fly in very good conditions as well, which is something that people have to remember, because I'm not always stranded at the very last row of A320, right? Sometimes I'm in the front. I've been very lucky to do that. Why? Well, you know what? The other part where I was very lucky is that I almost built my job around the fact that I wanted to travel. So after having done, I've done many things in my life. My career doesn't make a lot of sense. I was doing startups in the 90s after graduating from my master's in Geneva. Then I did many things. I was a lobbyist as well, working in the hospitality automotive industry. And then one day I just, you know, decided to give it all away, and I left to live in Tokyo in Japan. When I was there, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, because I thought at first that I would find a job, you know, and I did the 6-month crash course of Japanese, hoping that would be enough. Of course, it was not. And the luck was that it was the right time in the right place. It was 2008, and 2008 was when big companies that you've heard, of course, like Facebook and Twitter and others, were starting to become big and known, and they were looking for someone sometimes to help them understand the Japanese market, and I was just right there, and I was not doing a lot of stuff because I couldn't find a job, and I started building that around it. I was back then commuting back and forth, because I was born and raised in Geneva, Switzerland, so I was commuting back and forth to Europe to, of course, see my parents. And then after Japan, I moved on to live in Manila, as you mentioned, for a year for a client. At that time, these 3 years, I wasn't traveling that much. But then something happened in my family. My mother got sick, which, you know, happens. So I decided I needed to be closer and wanted to come back to Europe. But my client base was still in Asia. And that's where I started traveling much more, because I was basically living in Europe whilst most of my clients were in Asia. Of course, over time, this changed, because by simply the fact that I was living in Europe, I created a client base in Europe, and over time started losing a bit my client base, of course, in Asia. And, you know, and up for that, I started traveling left and right. One of the reasons I travel, though, besides being a consultant that helps companies figure out innovation, is that I'm also a public speaker. So I'm actually paid to go and speak at corporate events, etc., at sometimes big public conferences. And that obviously sometimes entices travel. Again, I also, you know, kind of engineered that a bit by basically declaring that, you know, at the beginning I was like, yeah, this worldwide speaker. Yeah, I had spoken in 5 conferences. But, you know, by declaring it a little bit, I kind of pushed and engineered it. And over time, yes, I was able to find. But you know what? When I speak to people that travel a lot, I don't travel that much. You know, like, of course, people see my
updates.
I do, but people see my updates, of course, and I'm very public about that, because I'm also like a kid when I'm in an airport and in an aircraft. But I have many friends of mine that work in a corporate world that would fly, you know, 300,000 miles a year, 400,000 miles a year. Like, and you know, and they don't talk about it.
What are you, how much are you flying? Do you measure it in thousands of miles or flights or hours?
It depends. I mean, there's so many tools that are funny to use. One I'll keep mentioning, it's not completely accurate, but it's pretty fun. It's called Jet Lovers. Jetlovers.com, where basically it gathers your Foursquare check-ins, Facebook check-ins, or Twitter updates. And with that, it creates a map of where you traveled. So usually after the fact, I know how much I've traveled, you know. So probably this year, we're now end of May, I must have traveled 100,000 kilometers this year already. I'm not sure I might be doubling that by the end of the year, but that's it. I'm not going to go over this because, you know, at the end of the day, I also need to work, you know, so traveling is fine.
Can't live on aeroplanes, however much we'd love to. But Paul, you mentioned when you were a kid, I think Geneva was your home.
Correct.
Then, wasn't it?
Correct.
You've talked on the podcast on layovers about your first couple of flights. Tell us about your first flight and what that meant to you.
Oh, so the first flights, I don't remember. The first flights, I know when it was, because my parents had this habit of putting the boarding pass along with the pictures in the photo album. So I actually have a recollection, proof of my flights. But I was probably like less than 1 year old, so you don't remember those, obviously.
All right, well, maybe not those. What's your first memory then of flying?
The first memory was my father is from Greece. My mother was from Finland. We would go to Greece by car, but we would go to Finland by plane. So really, my first memory is clearly having flown to Finland, to Helsinki, with a plane. I think we were actually connecting in Germany, so there was even a connection. Maybe that was my first layover, right? So but I don't have this like crazy recollection. I would say that for me, the first truly image that I have in my mind is the first time I boarded a 747, which was probably when I was 5 or 6 years old. So I was born in 1975. It must have been in 1980. And that was going to Miami. I do clearly remember entering the plane. I have this vivid image of the seats, how they looked like back then. So that for me, it was very important. At the same time, at the same trip, when I was in Florida, I saw, you remember how Challenger, the shuttle, how it was shuttled. It was on a special 747. I saw that 747 with the shuttle landing. You know, the highway was backed up, and suddenly everybody was out looking in, and I remember looking at that plane with the shuttle landing. So that's probably also why I so much love the 747, because it's really my first memory.
You do talk about it with Alex a lot, don't you?
Yes, we do.
And they're almost gone.
Oh, yes, sadly so.
Yeah, tell us then, what's your favorite aircraft?
Yeah, probably the 747. It has, it's probably because it's first, it's iconic. You know, it's the, even simply its shape has something very specific to it. Everybody can recognize a 747. By the way, we just say 747. You don't have to specify what you're talking about. Everybody will immediately understand what it is. And it also comes with this imagery of long haul travels from the 17th, you know, Pan Am and others. It has something to it. I just flew it again because it had been like 5 years I hadn't flown it. I've flown lots of 777s and 380s, but I just flew it again from Bangkok to Hong Kong 2 weeks ago with Thai Airways. And I was also very lucky to be for the first time, or at least for the first time in my memory, in the nose, you know, on the lower deck, like at the very, very, very front. And that was, you know, so amazing. I understand why people say it's an older airplane, because, you know, when the gear is taken up, you hear the old entire mechanics, everything like moves and shakes, and which is not the case with modern aircraft. But still, it has something to it. Maybe I'm just a romantic when I talk about that aircraft.
Let's talk about layovers. Let's talk about the industry and the passenger experience. I think both you and Alex, I think, quote unquote, share a passion for the experience.
Yes.
What do you think makes a good flight experience?
Well, first of all, it starts way, way, way before the actual moment you enter the aircraft. And that's what most people, but sometimes even people within the industry still don't understand it. That's that whole journey you're making is when you start even thinking about the fact that you're going, because most of the people, you know, you travel either because you're forced to, because it's business, or either because you want to, because you're going somewhere as a tourist. And for a tourist, if I take that example, you know, it's this inception point of that tourist is about the destination, how well I would get there. It starts very, very early on, and very few companies are playing on that. Of course, they're playing on the dream of the destination, but very few understand that, you know, the entire experience, whether even by, you know, looking for a destination, then booking the destination, then the entire process of being on the website or on the app or even on the phone and trying to find the right seats, everything. This has to be so easy to be a happy moment, if you want, because you're really looking forward to your vacation. Then, of course, you have the airport, which is, of course, not part of the airline, but still, you know, it's part of the experience. Some airlines are better than not to make that experience also less cumbersome or less of a hassle, especially security, but that's again not because of the airlines. And then, of course, the aircraft itself. I was lucky enough to be invited by Airbus recently when they revealed their new cabin concept. They call it the airspace. Airbus is trying. They've realized that a lot of people like you, like me, like Alex, but also more regular people that are not into aviation will say, oh, I know I am in an Airbus A380. And they will tweet about it, or Facebook about it, etc. So Airbus is trying to take a little bit the lead in that discussion and say, okay, we know that you're going to discuss about that experience. So we want to make sure that the product, the inside of the product we offer to airlines or to lessors, of course, because they are a big part of the industry, will create a better experience. We know that so many people are unhappy about flying because of, you know, the seats are becoming smaller, the legroom is becoming smaller, but I've recently flown the 787 for the first time. And for me, it will become an iconic aircraft because really, the little things they've done in it, which is the mood lighting, which is also the humidity control, which is how the light is, the pressurization of the plane, makes it, these little things that you don't see, that you just feel, makes it a much more comfortable experience. So it's a mix. There's no right answer to it. Flying will still always be for some people a hassle. Some people are still afraid of it, by the way, as well. But by doing little things, little details, you can augment that experience. And I think this is where now most airlines are realizing, but at the same time, the reality is that it's very hard to do because, as you know perfectly well, the margins of the airline industry are rather thin, right? It's really hard. It's a hard business to be in, right? It's not the glamour of what people think. So it's usually these little things that might not cost a lot of money that can augment that experience. It's not perfect. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm the total expert and everything I say is actually achievable. And again, I'm lucky, especially in long haul, to travel a lot in business class, which of course is a totally different experience. It's nothing comparable. But I realize, but I really insist that, you know, the vast majority of people are in the back of the plane, and this is where we should pay attention. We should actually focus how to make that 3 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, 18 or 19 hours very soon, apparently. How can we make these moments that can be a hassle slightly less of a hassle, at least?
Yeah. Paul, you mentioned the 787 there. You've also flown on the A350, I think, as well, from memory. How do they compare then in that experience?
So I have not flown the 350 yet. I'm flying it actually in 4 days for the first time with Qatar Airways. Of course, I engineer that because since I love aircrafts and I love the variety, when I book, I will try to understand which aircraft is actually on that route. Some sites like Google Flights gives you that information. Some others, you have to go on the website, you do a little bit of research. This is not the usual way of people booking flights, by the way, right? But I really wanted to try the 350. That's going to be next week. I hope the 350 has the same feel that the 787, because there's really a generational change in how I felt in that plane. And you know what? The 787, I flew it with Norwegian. Norwegian is not a luxury airline. Norwegian is a long-haul, low-cost airline. So don't think that I was like in some kind of residence, as Etihad does it in his 380s, like with a full room. It was a normal seat. But even with that type of seat, it was a fantastic experience. So I really hope that I will have a similar experience at the 350.
All right. Okay. And Paul, you've mentioned there that you don't always sit in the pointy end. you get to sit in all classes. And for listeners of the program of layovers, you do talk about the experiences. Over the past, I don't know, decade or so, when you've been really flying regularly, what are the major changes that you're seeing in the industry and where you think it might be going?
I will separate what happens in the long haul and to what happens in the short to medium haul. If you fly to Europe, basically the product that you'll have in front in the pointy part of the aircraft compared to behind is almost the same. You know, you fly Lufthansa, Swiss, Air France, BA, you'll have the same seats. BA, there are seven actually of planes, the XBMI planes, that's a bit different if you're in business class. But other than that, it's the same experience. The difference is, of course, the service. You have nicer food, etc. I believe that for that bit, I'd rather fly EasyJet, you know, because I'm a big fan of EasyJet myself. I had most of my very good experiences. The new seats they've been installing are very, very nice, much more comfortable than the old one. Of course, it's nothing, you know, amazing. It's not a sofa or something.
Yeah, sure.
But for 3 hours flight, 4 hours flight, it's perfect. What will happen, though, and we've already seen that in some airlines in the US and a little bit in Asia, is probably, you know, offering in-flight Wi-Fi, which we don't really have in Europe yet, and also streaming of the IFE. So airlines don't want to invest, especially for short-haul, invest in screens that you have in front of you. So what they will do, they'll allow you to come with your iPad, Android tablet, etc., and you'll be able to simply stream content. Of course, some of them will also make you pay for that privilege, but at least you'll have some content. Although more and more I see fellow passengers that I do the same have an iPad Pro, and I always have content on it. And when there's nothing on the IFE and when there's no IFE, because I never, and that's something, it's a quirk of mine, I never work in the plane. So I watch, I don't know, TV shows or a movie or, you know, some entertainment. Yeah. So that's the big thing that will change. It makes it a little bit more acceptable, these 3 hours, even if you're a little bit struggling for legroom. And again, you know what? I'm 6'5", so 196 centimeters. So I'm not, you know,
You're not the smallest.
Yeah, so I can feel that legroom thing. Of course, I'm very good, like most people that love aviations are. I'm going to seat guru in such websites, you know, which is the right seat, where is the emergency exit row, and then exactly 24 hours when the checking window opens, I'm like, at that same minute, I'm trying to get my seat. So you can.
I'm glad an expert like you is the same as me. I do that for the four or five flights I do a year on business, but 24 hours to the minute I'm there. It's funny. Why do you think, Paul, we have that sort of passion for aviation and aeroplanes?
It depends. I mean, I don't know. I know that for most people I talk to, I mean, first of all, most people don't have a passion for aviation, but they have a passion for the the destination, you know, where it takes you. You know, it's just a means of transportation to go somewhere. And some of us, maybe because, you know, as kids, again, for me, it was a 747. It was like, I can go everywhere in the world. And the thing to complement the answer of your previous question is, on the long haul part, we haven't seen, and it's starting with Norwegian and such airlines, the low cost long haul, which is so hard to actually make work. But soon enough, we'll be able to travel basically half of the planet for maybe like half, you know, 500 quid or maybe 200-300 quid. Or soon, I don't know where it's going, but I think this will happen too. And this, for me, the magical thing here is that it opens travels to not only the middle class, but even the lower middle class. You know, I mentioned at the top of the show that my parents were keeping the boarding passes in the photo albums. On some of those is the price of those tickets. You know, it's the price of 30, 40 years ago. When you look at the price 40 years ago, there's been a huge change. You can cross Europe for the price of a cab fare. So, of course, maybe the experience is not always the most fantastic one, but it's the price of a cab fare. And for me, that's the most amazing thing.
What do you want? You know?
Yeah, it's a democratization of travel. The fact that all of us can, most of us at least, can go pretty much anywhere in the world in less than 24 hours. And I find that wonderful.
Yeah. And Paul, just booking seats, a question I have to ask you, because I can hear somebody ringing in my head asking this question. Do you book a window seat?
I'm always a window seat. Although, I would admit, because I'm tall, if I see that there's no good window seat available, I might take, especially on short to medium haul, I might take an aisle seat because then I can extend my legs. So that has happened.
Yeah, I understand.
Me. Yeah,
and you mentioned the US there, and at the moment there's unfolding in the media and almost everywhere a bit of a battle between what we're classing as the ME3 and the US legacy airlines. You can sit on whatever side of the fence you want to, but there's change coming because of that. Those three, you know, we've got Qatar, Emirates and Etihad, they certainly have changed, and one in particular has certainly changed the landscape for airline travel, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think Emirates especially has been one that is so... Yeah. I mean, they admit it. One of the persons I have the most respect for in the airline industry is Sir Tim Clark, chairman and CEO of Emirates. Yeah. So when they started that in 85, they clearly said that what they were copying in a way was the model of Hong Kong and Singapore. You know, it's a free there were free ports that had airlines that would, you know, create this like destination for business people. This is what they did. On top of that, what they realized that was very clever is that, look, we're sitting in the middle of the world. And you can go to, I think, 90% of the planet in 8 hours from Dubai. So just because they have the right geography, maybe the great hub. So they invented that hub system that others were trying before. Of course, they didn't completely invented it, but they made it such a success. It's a wonderful company. Of course, the debate now that is being having in the U.S., because the U.S. is very scared of these airlines, but also in Europe, we have also Lufthansa, Air France, KLM that are a bit like uneasy about these airlines. There are some remarks of protectionism. I think, you know, in the end, I believe competition is good. When there's no competition, the product for you and me suffers. You know, the price also might go up and that's why we're seeing in the US, the price haven't gone up yet, but there's basically four major players that own most of the market, right? They're the big players in the US. So What I find very ironic in the position of the U.S., the speak for U.S. airlines, is that what they are fighting against, they're saying, okay, Emirates is subsidized. This is a big debate whether or not it's subsidized, as if a U.S. airlines didn't have any subsidies themselves in the past, or when they were a Chapter 11 or bankruptcy happened, or Lufthansa when they offloaded their pension plans. I mean, there's like many stories like that, but The most irony in that is that when you look at what the U.S. airlines are acting in Asia, so for instance, you can fly a plane that goes from San Francisco to Narita in Japan to Tokyo, and then continues the same plane, picks up some passengers, and goes to Manila, where I used to live. When Emirates tries to do the same thing by stopping, for instance, in Milan, that's the only thing they do now in Europe, so they Dubai, Milan, Milan, New York. They say this is unacceptable. This is called fifth freedom. This fifth freedom route is unacceptable. They shouldn't be doing it. So on one hand, they're doing that in Asia, but on the other hand, they're refusing anyone else to do that. By the way, the other one that suffers is Norwegian as well. Norwegian, although there's an open skies agreement between the US and Europe, the DOT in the US has been basically waiting. The file must be under a drawer somewhere, and they say, yeah, you'll get your permission to fly, and they have only a very few cities, and they're basically blocking for the same reason. So in the end, I think at least Emirates, it's a wonderful airline. It's a machine, clearly, but it's a wonderfully oiled machine. It's not perfect, but I think it's wonderful. The two others, I open to discussions, Qatar Airways and Etihad, because they're younger, right? So probably that they have more subsidies. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I've never flown Qatar. My first time will be next week. I've flown Etihad a few occasions, and it's also a wonderful airline. Whether or not are they subsidized, my answer is that when I see what other airlines in Europe, in the US, in Asia, what type of deal they've been having with government, what type of deal they still have with government, I see that debate is not fully... for me, it's not fully understandable. I think we should really talk about competition and what it's better for you and me as passengers, because at the end of the day, that's what you want. If Emirates wants to fly 10 times out of Manchester every day, fine with me. It creates more opportunity, because the thing also that really matters to me is that plane routes enable trade. Suddenly you can go, Peter, you can go to, I don't know, to Abu Dhabi I'll go there and I'll see if I can do business there. If there was no plane route, or if it was one that goes through a layover somewhere, that doesn't create the same thing. I think it really enables trade, and I think that's a good thing in the end. So my position is that I understand the position of U.S. airlines, and probably also some of the European ones, but in the end, I think competition is good.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk. You mentioned the word layovers. Let's go on to talk about the program. But first, I just want to, I suppose, bring it back to come forward. We've talked a lot about airlines and the experience and so forth. We haven't talked so much about airports.
Yes.
and the whole basis for the podcast layovers, one of my favorites, by the way.
Thank you.
It's really, really engaging, really enjoy it. Can't wait for it to come out, because you and Alex Hunter, you tell real stories, you tell real experiences. But before we talk about that, airports, what are you seeing in terms of innovation in airports to make that experience a bit more palatable for the passenger?
So there are two types of innovation that happen. The one is the lucky ones, basically the newer airports. It's the design of the airports themselves. You can feel that, when you compare, for instance, Manchester, the old terminal, to the new one, when you compare even a Heathrow, the terminal 3 and 4, to terminal 5 or 2, you can feel that the design, the layout of an airport is better thought nowadays than it used to be. Actually, Dubai, so the airport, the one, there's two, but the main one, the DXB, they know that just by the design of it, they can create better flows. So not only it makes a better journey for you as a passenger, but also it allows you to actually have more people within the actual building. Because if the flows are done correctly, then people move from A to B when they arrive to where they're supposed to be, in a very efficient way, thus allowing more people to be in the airport. The worst example for me of an airport that isn't exactly not made for that is Istanbul. Istanbul for me is a nightmare when you want to do a layover. They're opening a new one, right? The new one will be ready in 2018. Yeah. It's going to be amazing. So that's one innovation, but it's, of course, it's a long-term innovation because it requires basically to create a new building and not every airport. And we know that in the UK, we're not building a lot of new airports. The other big innovation is obviously has to do with the fact that we all have smartphones on us and these smartphones are becoming more intelligent. So not only that helps, of course, you getting your boarding pass and your smartphone and some information, but now we see, and Miami Airport has done that, Frankfurt Airport has done that, and other airports in the world, where basically you'll have beacons, which is basically they are low energy small devices that sit around the airport, and when you are close to them with your smartphone, they talk to each other, and they can give you information. Oh, you should go from this point to this point. Oh, by the way, you know, there's a lounge just on your right. Stuff like that. Frankfurt Airport, that's a good example, has done wayfinding. So when you need to download the Frankfurt Airport app. And Frankfurt Airport is also an airport that is not always very easy to figure out. They will not only tell you how to go from A to B like a map, but they will do that in real time. So they will know that at that security point, there's more people, or at that check-in counter, there's more people. And if there's an alternative, they'll let you know which one you should choose and how to get there the most efficient way. And I think these are small things that, again, augment your experience and make it slightly better. It's very early for the moment, right? It's Miami Airport has installed beacons all over its terminals, and now it's basically telling developers that create applications, say, you know, play with it, create something, you know, they enable innovation for others. And I think this is something that we'll see more and more happening. It's still very early, but that real-time thing, you know, knowing that, oh, at security, because that's usually the most painful part of the airport, at security now the line is 30 minutes, or you know what, at security the line is like 2 minutes, and knowing that even before departing from your home is actually very useful.
Yeah.
And also within the airport, telling you that, oh, you know what, there's an alternative security point that is less people. It's also because for the moment, you know, you just said earlier, Paul, you're an expert, and thank you for that. I don't know if I am one, but basically what I'm doing is I'm leveraging the fact that I know these kind of things. I know that at Frankfurt Airport, there's a secondary checkpoint in that terminal. Some people don't. These type of innovations will allow to use the existing facilities and make it easier for everybody to be an expert, right? And that's, I think, it's something that at airports will make the experience better.
And Paul, we talked briefly about the amount of flying you do. Do you ever worry about your health? We're spending that much time in a locked up tube.
Well, it's, you know, they say that radiation is obviously can be harmful. After, I think it's they say between 80 to 100K a year, it could become harmful. So I'm already above that limit this year. Yes, I'm obviously thinking about that. I'm obviously also thinking, besides my health, I'm also thinking that, you know, for all it's fun to fly, it's still very polluting as well. We can say that, and it's true, that modern aircrafts are making less noise, are more environmental friendly. They still use like a shit ton of kerosene to fly you from point A to point B. And when we talk about global warming, it's something that we have to think about. So it's, and you know, of course, when you book, you have this kind of, usually, oh, you can give £5 or $5 to, you know, offset your global, your carbon footprint. Well, that's nice, but this doesn't really actually change the face of the planet. So do I think about my health? Yes, I do. Maybe one day I will fly less. To be honest, you know, there's a part of me that really enjoys flying. There's parts of me, especially a month like this, when I have 23 legs in a single month, which say, you know what, at some point I would like to fly a little bit less. So I'll probably worry is a bit, maybe of a big word, but maybe one day will hit me in the face. So, and I'll talk to you again at that moment.
what's the longest flight? I know you and Alex have talked an awful lot recently about the longest flights. What's the longest flight you've taken?
There's two measurements to do a longest flight, either the number of miles you've traveled or the amount of time it took. I think in a number, the amount of time it took, it still is, I think, Paris to Buenos Aires, which was 14 hours and 30 minutes, which is by far not the longest one nowadays. You have 16, 17. I think the longest is, for the moment, is Emirates Dubai to Panama City. It's 17 hours and 40 minutes. And I think Doha to Auckland is about to open, which will be 18 hours. And then there's a number of the nautical miles you actually do. And that might have been Incheon to New York. But I haven't checked. But these are the longest flights I've done.
And what's your feeling about these 17, 18-hour flights? I mean, I love aeroplanes. I'm just thinking, could I put myself in one for 18 hours? I might get away with it, but could I put my family in one?
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest. Yeah. And the airlines themselves are not sure. Now it's a bit, you know, the latest... For a moment, these were not possible. Now with the advent of the 787, yeah, the 350, they've become, you know, they're... I think Qantas is thinking about opening a direct route from London to Sydney. So that would be also 18 to 19 hours instead of routing, yeah, via Dubai. But as you say, especially if you're in coach, I'm not sure it's actually... You know, I mean, for all the betterment we can do in the passenger experience, do you really want to be for that amount of time, yeah, on a plane? I'm not. Yeah, especially, yeah, you just said family with a kid. Oh, my goodness sakes. I'm honestly not sure that it will happen. It's a bit of a bragging rights for the moment, it feels like, you know, yeah, especially because, you know, it's Etihad and Qatar, and they're like, oh, our next flight will be 23 hours. So yeah, we'll, yeah, see. Yeah. Well, I think these will stay the exception. And
right.
I will try one day. I really want to do an 18 hours just to say that I've done it. But to be, yeah, honest with you, if I were to do that regularly, I would just, no. No.
<Yeah. laughs> Well, let's talk about stopping over then and layovers. The name of your podcast with Alex Hunter, of course. You're so busy. I mean, it's anyone who follows you can track you around the world. How do you find the time to do it? And more importantly, why?
The time to do what? To travel? To do layovers? Ah, the
podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it was a thing that... So Alex and I, we do work together on some project. We're both consultants. We've happened to work in many different projects together. And when we were talking, we kept talking about aviation. He has actually much more of a background in aviation because... His family,
yeah,
his dad
yeah,
was...
Yeah, great guest, by the way.
Yes.
He was a great guest.
So see, his dad was and is in aviation. He himself was part of the founding team of Virgin America, which was just bought by Alaska in the U.S.
Yep.
It's a very big shame for him. He's like...
He's
so unhappy about it.
I can feel it coming through.
And the thing is, we were talking... Whilst we were working on other stuff, we were kept talking about, oh, how was your last flight? And have you seen that news and exchanging messages and stuff? And I think it was just before Christmas 2 years ago, I told him, you know what? Because I already was running one podcast, totally different. And I said, you know, instead of just doing that, we should just talk about it the same way we talk, you and me, but we just put a microphone in front of us. So it really started like this. It was not meant to become anything more than this. But after only 3 episodes, we started getting a lot of people listening to us, and people were complaining about the quality of the sound. So then I suddenly had to learn how to do all the proper equipment, you know, buying a microphone and all the stuff that you know how to do, Peter, yourself, that I didn't, you know, because for me, it was just two guys having fun, and maybe we'll have, you know, 10
people. Do you know
people.
What, Paul? I got to interrupt you there. I thought that was a bit mean, some of that stuff about the audio quality. It genuinely wasn't that bad.
Oh, I mean,
I think sometimes people who get everything for free these days.
Yeah, it's true. You're right. You're
a little bit
right,
critical.
But so,
and it has gone from strength to strength. You know, you're getting great feedback.
Yeah, that's lovely. Actually,
you know, you can see from the sort of people that you've got a very wide demographic. You talk about, of course, layovers. You talk about all your experiences and that sort of thing. Where do you think? Where do you think layovers fits best? Because it's got a great feel to it. It's given great feedback to the likes of me and the many other listeners. Why aren't the airlines listening? Why aren't the airports listening? Why aren't they getting engaged?
We know for a fact that some airport executives are listening because we've had some feedback, so we know that's happening. For us, to be very frankly honest, we never engineered the show with a goal. It was, again, two friends chatting about what they love, which is why it has this feeling of being a mix of, oh, have you seen that news from last week? Oh, how was this travel you made? Because Alex also travels a lot. And it was never like completely engineered. Obviously, we both work with startups, so we also talk about the, you know, nowadays everybody yeah. does a new smart carry-on. So every week we talk about a new smart carry-on because we actually find that most of them silly, by the way. but there was never a goal. And now, over time, I think we have found found a tone which is, like you said, we never wanted to be only for AV geeks. We never wanted to be only a business podcast for airline executives. And we never wanted to be only like, you know, or like these freaking flyers, hacks, you know, how you get the better mileage out of your credit card. So it's a bit of a mix. And you naturally found kind of a, I don't know if it's a niche, but it's true that we got like a very, very wide variety of people listening to us. And I think we don't want to overthink it, because if we start to overthink about who we would like to target, then we'll start like maybe heavily talking about something and we lose part of the other. So it's really two guys chatting about how much they love aviation. Sometimes it sucks. We also say, oh, this sucks so much. And
you're very honest. And you know, one of the great things and you hinted at it earlier, is the service is not always best when you turn left through the door.
Clearly not.
And one of the things I'm fascinated by are all the things like the apps that you guys talk about, and the airports that probably in my lifetime I'll never go to. But I love the honesty about the service levels, particularly, you know, looking at first, business, economy, and looking at those balances, and the honesty in talking about those services as if I could relate to them, rather than what's often happened on these sorts of programs is we talk about the front end and wonderful and what sort of champagne, and that is good and I do love it when you guys talk about it, because I sort of can experience it through you in a bizarre sort of way. But I also like, as you mentioned, EasyJet there, and you know, the fact that, you know, it's a lot more practical and a lot more real, because it's real. You know, it's real when you say that.
It's really, and it's also the future. You look, the new BA CEO is the guy who basically started up Vueling, right? So,
the
future of travel, like I mentioned earlier, is more about these low cost traveling than actually the traditional way of traveling. You know, the point, there's even like this kind of myth about the fact that, you know, guys in the front are paying for everybody else. You know, like as if, you know, if they were not able to sell seats for $5,000 in the front, basically the airline would go bankrupt. That's not true, actually. It's true that it helps them a lot, but at the end of the day, you still have like 90% of the people that pay their flights and now sit in the back. So they are actually very important as well. And they are outnumber by a large, large, large number the guys in the front. And I say the guys because that's a bit also sad. Sometimes I tend to only see old white males in the front and like, world is still not very gender friendly. So you're right. I think this is very important, and I know we by definition we have a tendency of talking about the amazing experience. You know, I just flew, for instance, first class in Asiana, which is an Asian airline from a Korean airline from Incheon, Seoul to JFK, which I just mentioned was probably my second longest flight ever. I was in first class in a 380. Of course it was amazing, and of course I want to talk about it, because probably it's the only time in my life I've ever do it. It was a mix of the client had a budget and I upgraded myself with miles. And you know, it's a spillover effect. The more you fly, the more you get miles, the more you get able to do these kind of experiences. But I realize fully that this is completely, you know, let's put it another way. For me, every flight that I do that has this type of quality, for me, it's the last ever I will ever do. This probably the rest of my life I'll be flying in coach like everybody else does, and that's fine. And I really want that part of the flying experience to be as good. And this is something we just mentioned, Virgin America. I was lucky to fly them only once, but Virgin America, although the back of the plane in terms of the seats and the leg room and etc. was not that different from Delta or from, you know, whoever else. But the experience around it made me slightly better experience, which made me more happy than if I were to fly a nondescript airline. So these are the little things that I hope some do. And EasyJet, for me, honestly, in Europe, I know a lot of people complain because sometimes there's delays and whatever, but come on, it's not as BA doesn't have delays, right? It's EasyJet is a very good example of a pretty good experience. And you know what? The airline I usually used to despise, like, and I'm not very original because everybody does that, Ryanair, which is the other big one in Europe, Ryanair is actually changing nowadays. They're actually realizing that they've gone as far as they could and do the dirt cheap travel, and they have to enhance the experience. They've actually started doing, of course, the apps and whatever that goes around it, but even they change the seats. The new seats are actually more comfortable. They're trying to be nicer. Actually, their motto now, we have to be nice. It's not going to be again, it's not going to be Etihad, the residence, when you have like a huge bed for you. But
have you done that, by the way?
No, I wish I don't have that many miles on Etihad, and it's very hard to get there. Maybe one day, but honestly, this is, you know, this is also the kind of thing that the more you travel, the more you do miles, as I told you, but the more, for some reason, obviously, I tend to navigate around the airlines that will offer miles on my, and basically, I'm a Star Alliance status holder, and I try, because they're the biggest in the world, so I try to fly with them, thus Asiana, for instance, the Thai Airways, they were both on Star Alliance, and Emirates. So Etihad is not part of any, and, you know, I flew them a couple of times because it was the only option, but I don't think I will ever fly. And you know what? That's marketing, and they know it, you know?
Well, Paul, let me put you on the spot then. I asked you about your favorite aircraft. That's probably an easy one. What's your favorite airline?
That's really hard. That's really hard. I would say I have a...
Or what's the best? Let me rephrase that then. Maybe make it a bit easier. What's your best flight? What was the best experience you ever had?
Oh, it's probably the first time I was upgrading first class in Emirates, because it was only 5 years ago. Not that I've done many first class on Emirates. They used to be more liberal in upgrading. So, of course, the first time, imagine that, the first time you go and you're like, you know, it's at the gate, you know, your boarding pass makes a bad sound. You're like, oh my God, something, I don't have my seat, or something has happened. And they release you a new one, and I see seat 1A, and I'm like, you know, I didn't even connect. You know, I was going in a flight, and I said, oh, wow. And, you know, and you go, and it was for a long haul as well. It was from Japan back to Dubai. And, you know, when that happens, of course, the first time you are like over the moon and you're so enthusiastic. And I was trying, you know, because I was trying to be like, oh, I'm going to not show to the flight attendants that it's my first time. I own this, you know, of course. And I was caught very, very easily, because after, you know, when the long haul flights, usually after an hour and a half, they start serving food. And the food was not coming. So I started like, you know, I pressed a little button, and the flight attendant comes and said, hey, by the way, do you know what time we'll have food? And she looks at me with a huge smile. You know, the smile says, oh, that's your first time. She says, you know, the food is on demand here. So I was, all right. But then, of course, because the secret was out, I started like enjoying playing with the seat, taking pictures, selfies, and I'm not into selfies. So, of course, that's memorable. The other flight that was extremely memorable to me, that's a way, way much older flight. It was back in the 90s. I flew back from Costa Rica to Madrid, because it was Iberia, and it was the last ever flight of the captain that day. It was a 747. It was his last flight. He was retiring, basically. So all the staff were making him like jokes and stuff. They were like, they cut his tie, they cut his costume in pieces, and they invited me. It was, of course, pre 9/11. It was my birthday. And a friend of mine, and I was in coach, like very, very at the very back of the plane, obviously. And a friend of mine had given a small note to the flight attendant, can you do something for Paul's birthday? And that something was, I was invited in the cockpit with those guys. You had the captain, it was his last, like smoking a cigar. And it was, that, for me, it was like, wow, that was very memorable.
Yeah, those days are gone.
Yeah, those days are gone. In terms of the favorite airline, of course, Emirates is great, but I think, you know, I have a soft spot for Swiss, because, you know, I was born there, and a Swiss era was probably better for those who still remember it. Swiss, I have a soft spot. And I do honestly like BA. I do not fly them a lot, because I'm not on their, you know, I don't have status with them. But the quality of service for me is always, I always enjoy it, to be very honest with you. I enjoy this. Maybe it's because it's British. I don't know. I really do enjoy it.
Well, I just did Madrid and back in a few days. I flew Iberia and I flew back BA, and I genuinely was surprised at the lack of service on Iberia and the absolute difference for everything from the safety checks to the food to the just the ambience and the politeness of the crews. I was shocked that they're part of the same organization. So I sort of get it, because I drifted away from BA and went, you know, to Virgin and all those things when I was traveling for business. But I do understand what you're saying.
I will say one more thing here, is that also it's easier for some airlines, easier is a big word, but when you're a younger airline and all your staff is 25, they're more enthusiastic, they're more laid back, they're not worn out. I understand, you know, there was, I'm not going to say who, but there was this, I met two flight attendants that work for American Airlines, and they do, you know, long haul from the US to Europe and back. You know what they told me? That they told me after, you know, the Chapter 11s and everything that happened after 9/11 and the bankruptcy and whatever, they're not given food. They're not giving food. You know, so they basically are scraping whatever food is left from the passengers. And I was honestly taken aback. I was like, are you kidding me? You don't have food? And they said, no, we don't. And it's like I don't know, like a 9-hour flight or something. Yeah, I mean, when you have these kind of conditions, no surprise that the crew is, you know, is having a hard time, and then you cannot connect with them. When you're in Emirates, where they take better care of you, or even in Norwegian, which is just flying, and the crew is like 23 and so happy to be there. Of course, it creates a better environment and a better experience.
That's a very, very good point. That's a very good point, actually. Paul, I could talk to you for another 3 or 4 hours, but I think the best thing for us to do is to point our listeners at layovers so they can get an awful lot more of this content. As I said, I do highly recommend the program.
I've really
enjoyed it. Every couple of weeks, I know you both travel. God knows how you manage to schedule them in. But tell us, where can we find out about layovers online?
I actually edit during flying, usually, the show.
So. All right. Okay.
So it's the website is a bit, it's called layovers.2.to, because that was the only one available that I could find. You can find us on Facebook, if you just look for layovers, you'll find it. On Twitter is @lay_overs. See, we cannot have consistency here. But layovers.2, you'll have all the information. On iTunes, if you just look for layovers, you'll also have it listed there if you want to listen to it. But again, layovers.2, this is where you're going to www.layovers.2. You'll have all the information there. And never hesitate, actually, to reach out, because we also rely on people like you, Peter. Peter, you do it, actually. You send us, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And we thank you on the show, because, you know, we have so much to say, and sometimes we like to have stories from people that, oh, you know, I've done that flight and I've had that experience. So have you seen that news that you might not have seen? And we also thank them on, you know, we mention you, Peter, and others, because it's how we, and we invite people, and we'll get you one day, Peter. That's for sure.
I don't know about that.
Oh yeah.
I'd feel out of my depth.
No. You'll be there. No way you're not going to be invited as a guest.
Thanks very much. Well, Paul, it's been a delight speaking to you. Where are you off to tomorrow? Because no doubt you don't have another spare day free.
Yes, it's very rare. This month I'm only a few days in London, so I'm flying to Montenegro first with Austrian. We have their weird uniforms with everybody is fully red. It's very strange. To Montenegro, so to Podgorica via Vienna, and then I'm flying with Qatar Airways. No, with Montenegro Airlines to Zurich to catch a Qatar Airlines flight to Doha, then to Dubai. I stay one day in Dubai, then back to Munich. I stay one day in Munich, and then back to London with Lufthansa. So that's a lot of flights coming up.
Well, I'm tired already. Paul, listen, take very good care of yourself.
Thank you.
Look forward to the next episode, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Just want to say a big thank you there to Paul. He is a fantastic guy, lovely guy to talk to. Spent a lot of time outside recording talking to him there, so thanks very much. And if you haven't heard the Layovers podcast, it really is a fabulous listen, particularly if you travel. This isn't just about aeroplanes. It's a great travel listen. So do go over and have a listen to those guys. Okay, after the break, we're going to talk to British Airways pilot Mark Van Honecker about his book, Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
We have pilot and author Mark Van Honecker with us today, an author of the fantastic book Skyfaring. Mark, welcome to Extended.
Oh, I'm very happy to join you and your listeners, Peter. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. I know you've got a very, very busy life, but we want to talk about Skyfaring, your book. And first, congratulations on a wonderful book. It's one of those few books that's got so close to that feeling that I think most aviation fans have on why we love flight. But this book isn't just for aviation fans, is it?
No. I'm definitely an aviation geek myself. And of course, a lot of passengers are sort of flight romantics. And I wanted to write something that kind of appeal to aviation geeks and people who love the window seat or love just to watch planes from the terminal. But I also wanted to write it for people who don't necessarily like flying. I mean, it's sometimes said that aviation is kind of a victim of its own success. A lot of people have to travel as a part of their job or because they want to go see places, but they're no longer very good in the plane trip, but they're interested in where they're going. A lot of people, so many people live away from their family these days. So, aviation is simply a part of their family life. And so there's a lot of people, who do fly who may not enjoy it, or at least may not think about it in the ways that people did when it was still new. And so I was hoping that some of the, some people who've sort of fallen out of love with flying or who just haven't thought about it directly in a long time might ask for a window seat the next time they fly.
And the language you use is really eloquent, but it's not too wordy. It's very easy to read, but you capture the sentiment of travel and aviation very well. You got the balance about right. How challenging was it not to fall into writing too much technical jargon about the 747 or aircraft or flight? Because I just loved the easy way that it read.
It's interesting to me that you like balance, because I sent it to a bunch of friends of mine, and depending on their personalities, some of them said, well, it was a bit too poetic, or it was a bit too technical. It was definitely a tough balance. One of the hardest things for me was trying to summarize technical things in a way that was true to the facts, but that didn't get bogged down in detail. And there were a couple, there were a couple examples of that where, I write about inertial navigation systems, which I think are just these, these are these black boxes can track a plane's orientation and position over the earth without reference to the outside once they're initially told where they are. I always thought those are much cooler than GPS because GPS, it's obviously an amazing technology, but when you have that connection to satellites, it seems much more obvious how it's done.
Yeah, it's all digital, isn't it? It's press a button and point it'll all work. And I think that's one of the wonderful things that you talk about in the book, and you head the chapters, things like wayfinding, machine, place, and the lovely last or penultimate chapter, return. Tell us why you chose to sort of collate your chapters in that way.
Well, I wanted just the book to have an arc or a story, and it turns out that the flight, any flight has such a good narrative. It has takeoff, it has landing, it's really just that simple. And so, by starting the book with a discussion about takeoff and ending it about landing, I felt like there was a lot of freedom in between to sort of meander a bit. And I was making a lot of notes about various things I would, after I landed from a flight, I would be on the bus going into town in Singapore or Beijing or Mexico City, and I would just make a few notes on my phone about what are the things about the flight that would amaze me when I was a kid or before I was a pilot, or that still amaze me now. And those things just sort of fell out naturally into chapter headings. The one I didn't expect to write was about water. That came out of a couple different aspects of my job. I mean, I just love the sort of nautical language that fills aviation, you know, starting with the word aeronautical, but, you know, wake and knot and port and starboard and bulkhead and officers and rudders. And and then, of course, you know, the next aspect of that is simply how much water we do see. I mean, we see clouds and oceans and glaciers and snow more than we see land, you know, given the nature
of it. And I learned so much from the book as well, and I'd like to think myself as a little bit of a geek, but I learned a lot, and again in a very gentle way. I felt I was going along a journey as I went through the book. But we haven't talked about your journey yet and what got you to that pointy end of the aircraft. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you didn't leave high school and set out on a cadetship into an airline at 18. You had a career beforehand.
Yeah, so I had always been obsessed with airplanes since I was a kid. I had lots of model airplanes in my room, and you know, whenever we went to the airport, I would go and watch the planes if we had time. But we didn't know any pilots. I think aviation is one of those things that runs in families, and it doesn't run in my family. And so if I'd had an aunt or an uncle who were involved in the airline industry, it might have occurred to me earlier. Instead, I ended up working in the business world, and I had a consulting job, which allowed me to fly a lot, which was great. And in the meantime, I was looking at various training programs. That job was in Boston, but I was traveling a lot to Europe, and I have a European background, so I thought Europe would be a very interesting place to fly. And of course, the ab initio programs are something which aren't very common in the U.S. They certainly weren't common then. And I wanted to fly, I wanted to fly the 747 and maybe someday Concorde, and British Airways was the airline that when I was a kid I dreamed about, in Pan Am.
Well, everyone did, I suppose, back in the day, as they. But Mark, let me just take you a little bit. I've got a confession to make, by the way, because you talk a lot about your career as a management consultant, and you were taking lots of flights, and that was earning you some respite from this addiction to flight, but it wasn't where you wanted to be. My confession is I was also a management consultant in exactly the same position, and I started my flying training and dropped out. So confession over. You weren't a young man when you started your flight training. How did that go, and how was it being, I suppose, a slightly more mature student coming into the flight world, starting from scratch?
When I started my course, I was 29, and the youngest person on the course was maybe 19, and I found that everyone else was kind of scattered in between, and I found that age range quite. In a way, it was kind of fun. I mean, we'd come from different walks of life. Some people had not had jobs, but most of us had some kind of a career beforehand. And so, to the extent we were all living in the housing at the school in Killington, and that, you know, to go back to.
And where was that, Mark? Sorry,
that was at what used to be called Oxford Aviation Academy, north of Oxford in Kidlington.
I thought that's where you said. That's where my office is.
Is it really?
Oh, wow. and I don't know why I didn't pick that up in the book. So you did your primary training in the UK.
That's right. Although they sent us out to Phoenix for our visual flight training, but yeah. So being back at that in that sort of student kind of living was a little bit of a shock after having, you know, lived independently in a city. But it was kind of fun too. And it was definitely a bonding experience. I mean, we all, you know, those people are my closest friends at work now, even though we don't fly together all that often, simply because we had those formative years together.
Right. I want to come back to that point actually about meeting people during your career.
Yes,
but you did your primary training and your commercial training, and then you were snapped up by British Airways into a cadet course.
Yeah, so my course was actually sponsored by British Airways. It was the previous version of what's now called the Future Pilot Program. So I was on the last pre-9/11 cadet course that British Airways ran.
Wow.
And so I was very lucky indeed. my I was offered a course in May or October of that year, and I was going to take the one in October and travel. And my dad said to me, "You know, Mark, why don't you just take the one in May? You're going to spend plenty of time traveling later." And it's one of those lessons in the aviation world that you just timing is everything.
Yeah, sure. And bizarrely, that was when I was doing my flight training as well. It was one of the reasons why I dropped out, because the challenges that then came post 9/11. You transitioned into BA, and your first aircraft was the A320.
That's right. Yeah, my first flight was from Heathrow to Glasgow on an A320. In 2003, the beginning of 2003 of 2003.
Yeah. Now I want to ask you what it was like going into that glass cockpit and that environment, which we're very familiar with today. But aircraft were still, there were still some steam gauges around, and the A320 is a very modern aircraft, isn't it? What was it like to fly?
I loved it. It was an absolute joy to fly, and of course, coming from a Seneca, it was like going to the Starship Enterprise. it was amazing. I mean, I think people who've flown other airliners, older generations of Boeing airliners, maybe the Airbus is more of a change. Of course, for me, it was the only thing I knew, and I loved it. I thought it was it's really well designed. It's very ergonomically comfortable, and it has a lot. I mean, the side stick controller it's a joy to use it. It's a wonderful fly.
It doesn't feel right to me because I'm just a bit older and I need something to hang on to. But you eventually transitioned to your dream aircraft. That is the 747, and you fly the 747-400 now. You live in New York. You fly for BA. In the book, you talk an awful lot about flying the world. What makes being an airline pilot so special to you?
Well, part of it is simply the wonder of the machines. The 747 is just a beautiful, beautiful machine. And I really, sometimes when I walk onto one before a flight, I almost can't believe I'm allowed to be there. I just feel like a big kid. When you're doing a walk around, you certainly have that feeling as well, that you're very privileged to be there. And and then of course the simple act of flying is joyful, as anyone who's had a lesson in a small plane or large, or something larger, in a simulator, it is just an amazing experience to move in three dimensions like that.
Yeah, and the passion that you have for flight really comes through in the book, and I can hear it in your voice. I mean, I'm a big kid anywhere near an aeroplane, but I sort of get that feeling, so are you.
Yeah, I think that sense that we're big kids is it does kind of come through sometimes. And you see the things you see are just, I mean, it's really hard to find words for them. I went to Beijing a few weeks ago, and we spent it was an eastbound flight, obviously, and it's overnight. But at this time of year, of course, because you go quite far north, and we're coming into towards the solstice, it didn't get dark at all, even on this overnight flight. So you're looking down at Siberia from one end to more or less the other. We saw Mongolia when the sun was sort of back up in full swing. You're looking at these mountains of the mountains of northern Mongolia, and you kind of think, wow, this is be amazing. And then of course the other thing which drew me particularly to long haul flying is the chance to see those cities. I mean, to spend 2 days in Beijing.
And you particularly want to do long haul travel, didn't you? You had the option to. You do have the option in your career to fly long haul or regional and local, and you chose very much to do that. Why?
One of the nice things about working for an airline like British Airways is you do have that choice of short haul or long haul fleets once you have the seniority to bid for the one you like best. Europe is amazing. I mean, it's an amazing place to spend time. You get a lot of sectors in. And the cities and cultures, of course, are so different that you do get a lot of diversity within those short flights. But there was something about I had a Globe when I was growing up. I've got a Globe at home now. And there's something about the truly planetary scale of long-haul flying. We've just announced, we're starting our, I think it'll be our longest flight ever to Santiago de Chile. And, that's going to be, London and Santiago are really quite a long way apart. And
it's, I did ask Paul about that, how he felt about these 17-18 hour flights. How challenging are those really long flights for the pilots? We know you get crew rest, but that's a long time still to be coming back to the desk, as it were, and being on point, as sharp as a nail.
Yeah. I mean, it is. Everyone manages their sleep their own way. One of the nice things, of course, is that once you we start out with two. It all depends on the flight time and the departure time. But we start out with two pilots, and then we add a third. But above a certain time, you get a fourth.
Right, okay.
So once you hit, Singapore was the longest flight I've done on the 747. But because there are four pilots, you can get a break of 6 hours. I mean, it's not quite a full night's sleep, but it's pretty close. I mean,
yeah. The great thing that brought out for me is how, you talk about the globe, and networking we talked earlier, how small the world has become with this capability for long-haul travel. And you talk about networking incidents, being a pilot, and you about people you meet, sometimes you might not see them for many years. Give us a little insight into this, what can sometimes be a lonely life, yet amazingly rewarding for you.
Yeah, well, one of the nice things about the 747 fleet getting a little smaller is that we tend to fly with the same pilots more often.
Right. But
there is this, you do have these weird arcs in your social life this way. I mean, before I joined BA, I actually was flying from Tokyo to London, and I went up to the flight deck back in those days and stayed up for landing. And one of the pilots on that flight is someone I still run across every few years. And I've actually,
that's amazing.
And I've actually flown with him, and he met me when I was just some geek down the back who wanted to sit up in the front of the cockpit. And I'm still that geek. I'm just down in the cockpit.
But the great thing is and was that, and certainly when I ever did it, and when I took my kids up to the cockpit, I always felt like we were so welcome. It's a sad state of affairs that we don't have that anymore. Tell me about people coming into the industry. I've just read your article on Slate.com about becoming a pilot. Fantastic article. For some of those people maybe wanting to come into the industry, what would you say to them? Because they can't go and sit next to you in the cockpit now. So how do we get them? How do we get these people into the industry?
Well, one reason I wanted to write the book actually was to relate some of the kind of things that people told me about when I went up as a passenger. So in a way it's what I would show you and tell you if you could come up. And more generally, I think, it maybe it goes in cycles, the interest in the industry. I mean, there is talk about a pilot shortage, certainly in the U.S. And that will feed down in its own way, I think. I do think that, one of the challenges is that, there's so much technology in our hands now in an iPhone. And when you look at a light aircraft that might be something that you train on, some of them have glass cockpits now, but a lot of them, of course, are old school for good reason. That it's just, I can imagine it can be hard to convince somebody that is really as amazing as it seemed in the days before, and computers were so powerful and amazing and could do so many things in our hands. Maybe it'll come around to that again, to realize that big plane is a wonder of its own, and it's on this continuum that goes all the way up to an A350, and that your career. Yeah. And your career might follow the same path that the world of aviation has taken.
Well, Sunday Times bestseller, Book of the Week, BBC Radio 4's Book of the Week, Guardian Book of the Week. There's so many acclaims to the book over the past 18, 20 months since it's been out. The paperback is due out in the UK July, first week of July. Did you expect it to be quite this successful? And what's it like to be so popular? Does it interfere with your flying?
Well, I didn't expect any success from any book. I mean, I've got a few other friends who've written books, and they've warned me. They warned me in advance. You know, just it's a tough, you know, it's a tough market, I guess is the word for it. Yeah, I'm very humbled and grateful. And
you do get recognized, don't you?
Just very occasionally. I've somebody on the train at Terminal 5 going out to the satellite gates recognized me and had a copy of the book in his bag on a fund, so that I was able to sign that. Yeah,
it's amazing.
And then he gave me a copy of his book. He'd actually written a book about the DC-8. We kind of exchanged books on the train.
Well, I'll bet that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, and of course, some of my colleagues know the book, but you know, many don't, and you know, that's absolutely fine with me. Yeah. I'm very happy to go back to work and just have a regular flight of the kind that I was in love with for my whole, you know, for as long as I've been doing it.
Yeah, and the great thing is that you still are, and I know you talked to Paul about, you know, taking some time off, and then when you come back, you know, it's all very fresh and you love your job, and you know, the Slate article supports that in terms of there aren't many jobs these days where people can have such a love and a passion for. You love the 747. She won't be around forever. What's your next ideal aircraft, Mark, because Concorde's sadly also no longer on the horizon.
Yeah, well, it's actually a tough question in some ways. I mean, we've had when I joined the 747 fleet, you could go pretty much anywhere in the world on it. And now, you know, some of them are being refurbished, so it's not going anywhere for a while. But eventually, I'll switch. And it's a tough one. The A380 has some amazing destinations. The 777 has essentially as big a network as the 747 had in its heyday. The A350s are coming soon. But I really do love the 787. I think it looks great. I've been on the flight deck, and you know, I mentioned the Starship Enterprise. I mean, that really does look like the Starship Enterprise. And
I don't think we've spoken to anyone who hasn't waxed lyrical about the 787. The A350 is supposedly its equal, and that's to come. Does having flown the Airbus before, having flown both Airbus and Boeing, give you any sort of advantage in terms of that decision you're going to make?
No, we always bid in terms of seniority, and if you've got the seniority, then you're, you know, then you can take the course. You know, I expect that going back to an Airbus, you know, just a little bit of even the small things like the terminology, like auto thrust instead of auto throttle, and you know, flaps zero instead of flaps up. You know, those small things will probably come a little bit easier to me. Yeah. As they would to anyone going back to the Airbus from another aircraft. But of course, the side stick controller would be you know, the advantage of the side stick controller is that you can have a tray table.
Yeah.
Which is a great thing for doing paperwork or having lunch. Whereas you know, on a with a control column and control wheel, it's a little harder to balance your meal tray. But
yeah. Well, I won't ask you that question that many of our pilot guests get asked: Are you a Boeing man or an Airbus man? We'll park that one for another day. But Mark, it's a wonderful book. I really, really did enjoy it.
Oh, thank you.
Read a description of you as a flight romantic, and it does come through very much in the language. You can pick this book up, you can put it down, you can come back to it a month or two later if that's your whim. I went end to end. I couldn't put it down. Paperback's out next month. Mark, how can we track you on social media? Whereabouts can we follow you?
I'm on Twitter at MarkV747. No surprise for the numbers there. And then the website, skyfaring.com, is up. And it's actually got a photo gallery of window seat images that readers have sent me. So if any of your listeners have a great window seat shot, I would love to see it. And it's a great way for me to experience parts of the world and aircraft and weather phenomena that I haven't seen myself. It's a real education for me as well.
All right. Well, we'll put links to that in the show notes as well. You're very active on Twitter, and it's not all about flying, is it? There's a lot about travel and other things as well on there.
Yeah. I mean, there's if I see something that I, especially travel related stuff, I figure that anybody who's you know, following a pilot who wrote a book about flying, might be interested in some of the travel stuff as well. So, and that's
yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah, that's a great, and I read people's, you know, the things people post on similar subjects are always really interesting.
Yeah, it really matches up. It really matches up well. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. Wonderful, wonderful book, Skyfaring. Congratulations on all the success. It's well deserved.
Thank you, Peter. I'll see you on board sometime, perhaps.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Penguin Fox 3, Bullseye 060, 25-16,000.
Great interview there with Mark. Tim, I know you've been pretty, you felt pretty strongly about this book, mentioned it before. Nice guy.
Pretty strongly in a good way, yes. I mean, I just love Skyfaring. It's such a good book for the... You know, for, like you said, it's not just for AV geeks, not just for aviation enthusiasts. It's the kind of book you can give to anyone who's kind of just, you know, been on a flight and wondered what goes on at the front end. Really, yeah. Lyrically written. It's he also writes, you know, sort of regularly for other publications, yes, as well. You know, sort of, I think one of his
great
recent
articles.
Ones was on was it AeroEase? You know, the language, yep, of the sky. You know, and how and Skyfaring. You know, one of his points is how it's kind of evolved. The language of the sky has evolved from the language of the sea. You know, so port, starboard.
Yeah.
You know, the captain. You know, the purser, etc., which is just lovely stuff. And all these little, you know, the wonderful thing about sort of Skyfaring is the, you know, the lyrical descriptions of you know, clouds and the sea, and also these little kind of little factoids that you can get lodged in your brain about, you know, reporting points or that you know, that the how it all comes together. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, really, really, really good book. Really pleased to have got Mark on the show. Now, we ran a competition to win a copy of Mark's book. We had three copies to give away. All you had to do was message us with hashtag Skyfaring and hashtag AvBook. And the three winners selected at random are Ian B., Ray Davis and Stephen Johnson. So well done. You'll be absolutely delighted when you get those books. We'll get your addresses off you and we'll get them over to Penguin and we'll get those out to you. So a big thank you to all the team at Penguin Books for supporting this feature. Okay, there's still plenty to come, and after the break we get to your feedback and then on to promoting aerospace.
This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PaxX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended. Peter, Tim, and Gareth do a stellar job and bring us all interesting and informative episodes. Extended, a great aerospace program.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
So, to the Get Involved and Feedback section of the show. First, we're overwhelmed by the response to our last two Boeing-supported episodes. So, a really, really big thank you to Boeing and to everyone else who supported those two shows. Of course, one from Farnborough and the fantastic interview that Tim had with the historian at Boeing. So, thank you very much for that. Too much to share, so we're going to move on to some other feedback. We posted a BBC Spotlight video with a recent guest, the curator of the Fleet Air Arm Museum, Dave Morris, on the Royal Navy's World War One pilots and the Sopwith Pup. Stephen Jackson wrote in and said, my granddad was in the Royal Flying Corps. He was a mechanic and used to tell us about how they were made to go up with a pilot after repairs so that they made sure they were doing it right. And he posted a picture of himself and his son, who is involved with building a Sherwood Ranger biplane called the Spirit of Ghoul. And the lady in the picture is Mary Stopes, the daughter of Barnes Wallace. So he posted that picture. I'll put a link to the Spirit of Ghoul in the show notes. Good friend of the show and naval air historian Matt Willis responded to that. He said, there is a book on the pup that was out last year. It had good reviews, though I hear the author is not to be trusted. That book, of course, is his book on the Sopwith Pup. So do go out. Guideline Productions, £13. It is a terrific read, as all of Matt's material is. Ray Davis from Down Under sent us a note. He was a bit worried. He sent it to us in the middle of the night and woke us up. I don't sleep with my iPhone under my pillow, Ray, but I am committed to extended. He sent us a link on 18-year-old Australian Lachlan Smart, who's flying around the world in an SR-22. He's currently at Biggin Hill and just about to set off. So we'll put a link to his website in the show notes as well. So Ray, thanks very much for pointing that out to us. We always talk books at this point in the show and mention the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook. And their current photo lead story is the stall full of books. I think it's Simon Watson, the aviation bookshop owner, and it's a picture of all his books at an air show. And I think there's been a lot of comments about that and how many of those books our listeners want. So what am I reading? I'm currently reading Concord by Jonathan Glancy, and I've also just started The Kamikaze Hunters, Fighting for the Pacific, 1945. Pretty well unknown story of the British carrier fleet and the pilots supporting the US forces out there trying to finish off the Pacific War. That's written by Will Iredale. Really, really enjoying that. What are you reading at the moment, Tim?
I'm reading something on a Royal Australian Air Force pilot flying Meteors in Korea. So this is called Without President, Owen Zupp, and it's a book about his father, who started off actually as a sort of like a commando in World War II, and then, wanted to be in the Air Force, got moved sort of sideways into the Army and commandos, went out to New Guinea for a little bit. The war ended. Came back into the Air Force in Australia, and ended up flying Meteors over Korea in the Korean War. Very, very hairy stuff. Ground attack in the Meteor seems particularly dangerous because they had a big ventral fuel pack, which seems to be a massive, huge, big target for the enemy. and that's called Without Precedent. It's by Owen Zupp. He's on Twitter. And it's about Philip Zupp, his father.
He's
really good read.
Yeah, he's a really good friend of our cousins down under on Plane Crazy Down Under. So some of you may know Owen. But we'll put a link in the show notes to help promote that. Any good books that you've read recently or are reading at the moment, Marissa?
Well, I just recently read The Island of the Sequined Love Nun by Christopher Moore. And I love comedy. When I have time off, I read comedy. And this one has a cameo appearance that it has to do with aviation. Amelia Earhart makes a cameo appearance in this book, and it's got, what's really fascinating to me is it talks about the cults of the shipping containers. I didn't even know there was such a thing, but you learn everything about the Pacific, and it has a lot of aviation to it. People are actually worshiping a crashed aircraft on it. So it's a funny one. The other book that I'm always reading, and I think everybody should read, is Jetliner Cabins by Jennifer Couts Clay, who, by the way, designed the interior of the worked on the design of the interior of the Concorde for British Airways and lots of their other programs. But if you know, she's my reference book. Whenever I forget something about the history of aircraft interiors, I always go for Jetliner Cabins, which I keep on my iPad as a permanent app.
Right.
So those two. I know the first one's kind of quirky, but it's worth it.
Well, why don't you tell us what you're reading at the moment or what you want to recommend? And if you contact us either on Twitter or Facebook or by email, hashtag that with AvBook. One other book to mention, it's close to my heart, as everyone knows, and that's going back to our good friend Matt Willis. He's made an announcement that his forthcoming book on the Fairy Barracuda is now available for pre-order. I think it's due out later this year, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
The Voices in Your Head .com.
Okay, let's move on then with promoting aerospace. A few mentions to kick things off. Sam Worthington Leese, of course, we spoke to in episode 52 from the Typhoon Project, has told us that they're working on a new website, which they hope to have live very, very soon. And they are hosting a meet and greet later in the year at the Boultby Flight Academy at Goodwood. It's going to feature the chance to sit in one of their Spitfires or a Mustang, and hopefully they're going to have a Typhoon veteran there as well. So we'll put links and reminders of the Typhoon, the Hawker Typhoon restoration work that they're doing in the show notes. One final mention from me is the Dorset Plane Pull, and this is charitable teams pulling a 30-ton 737. It's at Bournemouth Airport at 10 a.m. on Monday, the 29th of August. We might see, because it's pretty close to home, if we can get down there to do a little bit of a feature and talk to some of the fantastic charities, including the John Eggin Trust and my favourite, the Margaret Green Animal Rescue Charity, who are involved in trying to see if they can pull it the fastest, the furthest. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Tim, any shout outs?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, people know that I'm a big flight simulation fan, and coming up in October is what is billed as the world's biggest flight simulation show, Saturday, 8th of October 2016, at the RAF Museum in Cosford. So that's Flight Sim 2016. You can find it online at flightsimulatorshow.com. And it'll be worth, obviously, if you're a Flight Sim fan, you'll already, you know, be having it marked in your diary in the UK. But also, it might be worth going to if you're curious at all about virtual reality like Oculus Rift and the Vive, HTC Vive, and you want to sort of try it out and see whether it is as much as a game changer as people say. People are, you know, some people are there raving about it. It's quite expensive. But the people who have tried it are saying that they are blown away, and it is the next best thing to flying yourself. You know, the immersion is incredible. So if you are on the fence about that or you're curious about it, I'm sure there will be developers and people there with Oculus Rifts and Vives to try on and play with and try them out.
Well, our last Flight Sim show, Tim, was really, really popular. I was genuinely surprised by the interest that everyone showed in that episode. So maybe we should do another one.
Could do, yeah. Yeah, maybe get, yeah.
All right, we'll do that. Marissa, anything to promote or publicise?
Well, yes, our colleague InFlight Feed started a Kickstarter. It's really interesting. He's trying to work with airlines around the world to do the world's first documented movie about preparing food for the in-flight experience. So the history of it, featuring all kinds of airlines around the world, that he'll go behind the scenes and look at the restaurants. And he's at InFlight Feed, all one word. And I think we should all pitch in. I mean, it's just a little bit, but I think it'll be a fascinating bit of history of that cabin experience. It's something that we've never seen before. It's an Indiegogo, by the way. I'm just...
And is that InFlightFeed.com?
Yeah. It's in flight feed. So he's on Indiegogo, raising money. And, you know, I think it's really well worth it because there is nothing like that in the industry.
Right. Well, we'll put a link to that as well in the show notes if you're interested in supporting that. Sounds fascinating. Now, if you've got an event you want us to promote or some news from your local airfield, email us at getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk. Remember, this doesn't have to be in the UK either. We're happy to promote events all around the world because that's where our listeners are. Now, finally, the last episode from Farnborough was the final one where Event Fire Solutions were supporting Extended. And again, we want to send a big thank you to Tony and Paul for all their kind support. We currently co-promote the Aviation Historian publication in the show, as we have a reciprocal advertising arrangement with them. If you're interested in supporting Extended or in doing a reciprocal advertising deal, do get in touch with us. We'll produce the ads for you, and that's all going to be part of the service. Now, we do rely on support from our supporters for equipment, software and web costs for the show. So if you'd like to make a donation, then you can find the link on our website. And we'd love to thank Neil for his very generous donation, which we'll be using to help support these costs. So thank you very much, Neil, for that donation. Okay, that's about it. It's time to wrap up. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. And you can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask, though, before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm on Twitter at RES, Tim R, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
Marissa, a reminder about Flight Chic and where we can find you on social media.
Well, I'm at Designer Jet, so all one word, and Flight Chic is C-H-I-C. Putting the chic in flight.
Very good. And of course, you can find Gareth Stringer at globalaviationresource.com, and you can find him on Twitter as Gareth_Stringer. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. That's it. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Marissa Garcia.
Goodbye, everyone.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everyone. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended.
We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Marissa Garcia. You can say goodbye now.
Oh, goodbye.
Should we do that again?
Goodbye. Yes.
No one for the outtakes.
Sorry, Marissa, I should have warned you about that, shouldn't I? Okay.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.